This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Door County composer and musician Fred Alley was prolific in his short life. We'll talk to two Wisconsin musicians who released an album of his songs and find out about his legacy here in the state and beyond.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a profile of an Appleton-area musician.
A lot has happened in Adriel Dene's life over the last few years. The Appleton musician started a skincare business, became a mother, and co-founded The Refuge and Neighborhood, two creative spaces for artists in Appleton. Dene spent many years as a traveling musician, most notably with Corey Chisel and the Wandering Sons. But this year, she released her debut solo album. It was produced by Grammy winner Nora Jones. I recently talked with Dene, who says music has always been a part of her life since growing up in Chicago.
I grew up in the Uptown neighborhood, which is sort of on the north side of the city, close to the lake. And I grew up in a big old hotel called the Chelsea Hotel. I grew up in a collective with about 500 people that were living communally. And the arts and music was such a natural part of my environment. I remember walking down the halls and just sort of hearing music coming from different rooms, you know, people playing their guitars and singing and stuff. We would do this big block party once a year in this bank parking lot. All the choirs from the neighborhood would come and sing, and that was like the highlight of my year. And there's no time to be standing on the edge of things. Music for me is really, it's always been my therapy. So I've always played and sang, but it's been a real private thing. I've been in bands and I've always loved the collaborative aspect to making music with other people and even helping to color in another person's vision. But when it came to the idea of sharing my music with other people, my personal songs, that was a real hurdle for me. This is my first swing at my own songs. I've been writing for a long time. And all of the material on the record is, you know, fairly old now, but I think I like the recordings now more than I did when we finished them. I made it in Brooklyn. Actually recorded it in Nora's home studio. She created such a lovely environment, and I'd also never worked with a female producer. I'd never even worked with a female engineer. I was so used to being the only female in recording environments. Probably the most precious thing that I walked away with was an access to trusting myself in a deeper way. And that was watching her. And also, I felt like she trusted me, and that made it easier for me to trust myself.
Adriel Dene released her self-titled debut solo album this year. The Appleton musician's record explores the uncertainties, hopes, and anxieties that many people face in life. She talks about a couple of the songs, like Build a World.
I can build a world in little pieces. That was one of the last songs I wrote before I went to New York. I was thinking about what I would say to a child coming into our world right now. And this has only maybe happened to me 3 or 4 times in my life, but I just sat at the piano and it was just sort of a stream of consciousness. The whole song came out, like start to finish. I found out I was pregnant just 2 days before I went out there, so my life really dramatically changed in those months of finishing the record. And I thought that it would just be super simple, you know? I thought I was going to have this baby and he was just going to lay there while I played my piano. And it's really hard to admit that. Yeah, I mean, he was born and I felt this huge separation between me and my creative self. I could not get back to her. And that's really what was the hardest thing for me, was that I just lost my most immediate form of therapy.
Lately, I've been afraid of getting old and losing what I love before I've let it grow.
There's another song, I guess, that I think I wrote the very next day called Troubles. I feel like that song has been sort of a personal, self-fulfilling prophecy, I guess. And so each time that I perform that, I feel like I uncover something new in myself. And it's one of those magical songs for me. I feel like it is a gift that my subconscious gave me to learn more about myself.
I've got to find a way through the hope and find a way to believe in that I find a way to love myself.
When I was a kid, I really didn't think I would ever live in a city smaller than Chicago. And now I can't imagine living in a city larger than Appleton. I find there to be a lot of possibility. I really like living in a place where people are building new things together and where that's doable. As an artist, it's a really affordable city and there are a lot of creative individuals there and a lot of people who also aren't putting themselves out necessarily as working artists but are really dedicated to their craft. And for the season I'm in as an artist, I'm finding that to be really valuable to be around people that are thinking that way, not so focused on how to commodify their work, but really dedicated to their craft. And it's a city that's evolving and changing a lot right now, too, and I think it's really energizing.
Adriel Denae is a musician based in Appleton. Her debut, self-titled album, is now available. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, on Facebook, and on Twitter. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a look at the career of Fred Alley, a well-known Wisconsin songwriter and musical theater creator. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll find out how the chili pepper took over the world one delicious dish at a time.
Now, Wisconsin composer and musician Fred Alley was prolific despite dying in his 30s. His musical theater credits include Guys on Ice, Lumberjacks in Love, and The Spitfire Grill, which is one of the most frequently performed musicals in recent decades.
While Alley is best known for his musical theater work, he also founded the American Folklore Theater in Door County and wrote standalone music as well. Wisconsin musicians Katie Dahl and Rich Higdon were part of a team that recorded and produced a new album titled Solid Ground, The Songs of Fred Alley. Katie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Rich, great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Tell us about Fred Alley.
Well, he was a real dynamic force in the Door County theater scene and really in the Wisconsin theater scene in general. And he was a playwright and an actor and a singer and co-founded Northern Sky Theater, formerly American Folklore Theater. And he was also maybe less known as a singer-songwriter, but he was a folk singer-songwriter. And so it's in that capacity that we came to make an album of his songs. Yeah.
And his musical theater, what are some of the pieces that people might know?
So probably the best-known one in Wisconsin is Guys on Ice. And that actually has been done nationwide. It's seen a lot of productions. And he co-wrote that with James Kaplan. And then he wrote The Spitfire Grill with James Valk. And that has seen worldwide success, literally. It's been translated into several languages and been done off-Broadway and all over the place. So I think he wrote 10 or 12 book musicals in his life. He died really young in 2001 at age 38, suddenly of a heart attack. Mm. And it's amazing what he accomplished before that time.
It's really incredible when you think about it. How did you come to release an album of his music?
Well, Rich and I play music together a lot, and we happen to know a lot of Fred's songs, and a lot of them I learned early on. Rich heard a lot of them early in his time in Door County, too, and so we perform a lot of them, and we one day we're getting a lot of requests for Fred Alley, and we just decided to do all the Fred Alley songs we knew, which was maybe seven or eight. And so we decided to get together with our friend Eric Lewis, who's a flat picker from Memphis, and David Alley, Fred's brother, who's an engineer and has a studio in Door County. And we thought, oh, well, we'll make an album of Fred songs, which are sort of sadly relegated to cassette and vinyl, so they don't get played as much as they ought to. So it was kind of an idea that we had in a year when I hadn't written that many songs. We just had a child, and we thought, all right, here we go. We're going to make an album of someone else's songs.
Rich, the 12 songs that are on this album, is there kind of a theme or a feel that you think run through them?
Well, we just listened to the album again, and there's definitely a feel that runs through it. And it might have as much to do with the songs, like what our choices were. The way we picked the songs, Dave, Fred's brother, gave us access to everything that he had that Fred had recorded. So a lot of stuff that had never been released or that no one else maybe had ever heard. And we kind of picked between the songs that we liked, some that we already knew, and then some that we thought would be appealing to sort of everybody.
And what state were those songs in? Was there actual sheet music that you could just pick up and play and say, oh, here we go? Or did you actually have to kind of recreate these songs?
There was no sheet music. I went down to Memphis, where Eric Lewis lives, and together we made charts, which is, you know, what we non-classical players read music off of. And Eric is a real quick chart maker. Mm. So he would just sit there and scribble down, and then that's how we came to sort of make basic arrangements. As far as I know, none of these songs were written down really in any way.
Wow. And what does it feel like? Obviously, all of you, I think, had a real sense of honoring Fred Alley and his legacy and his tragically short life. What's it like taking music that has not really seen the light of day and making it your own, or do you try to stay as closely to what he did?
Well, we didn't stay too close to what he did, although there was a couple spots where there were, I think I would say, unusual little phrases that were tossed in, and we didn't understand why they were put in, but we kept them in because Fred did it that way. Mm-hmm. But I think mostly we interpreted it the way we could with our skills. Fred was an amazing singer, so finding the right key for the singers was a challenge. Mm. He's a very skilled tenor, and you may notice that I did not sing really on any of it.
Know your limits, right?
That's right.
Well, the title of the album and the first track on it is called Solid Ground. Katie, can you tell us about that one?
Yeah. That was one of the first ones I listened to when Fred's brother Dave had given us this sort of treasure trove of everything that Fred had recorded. And I had never heard that song before, despite being a lifelong Fred Alley fan. And it really seemed interesting to me. It stuck with me after my big, long marathon listen in a way that a lot of the other ones didn't. And I thought that was worth paying attention to. And we decided that it would, the way that Fred had recorded it was a real slow ballad, and it lasted a long time, and it was beautiful and slow. And we decided we'll make it a little bit more anthemic and driving. Hmm. And it's the only song on the album really that is a true duet. So vocals are pretty evenly shared between Eric Lewis and me. And that seemed like a cool way to use our skills and to open the album. And there's a line on there in that song, when the day goes down in this one cop town, I won't be back tomorrow, but I'll leave my song for you to carry along. It's always yours to borrow. Hmm. And it seemed like sort of a benediction.
Right, yeah. Right. Oh, that's great. Let's hear a little bit of Solid Ground.
If you go far enough, you will always come back round. If you dig deep enough, you will find solid ground.
We are talking with Katie Dahl and Rich Higdon. They are two of the musicians who put together a new album of music by Fred Alley. It's called Solid Ground. And how did each of you discover Fred Alley and his music? Rich?
Well, I moved up to Door County after I finished college and I got a job at a pottery studio, and I wasn't sure if I was still going to be playing music. And there was a scene sort of that happened, and it happened a lot around campfires and places where a lot of young people hung out. And Fred was always present in that and had an influence. And so I met him without even knowing anything other than he was a guitar player and a great singer. And then I just kind of sort of was slightly connected with the theater over the years, never really working for them until recently, and just sort of welcomed in the community.
Hmm. And what about you, Katie?
Well, I, of the four of us who made the record, Eric Lewis, Dave Alley, Rich, and me, I knew Fred the least personally. But I grew up American Folklore Theater, Northern Sky Theater, super fan. So I loved going to that theater. And I sort of got to know Fred through that. And as I got older, mm-hmm. met him plenty of times, talked to him a few times. But he died when I was 18. So I never knew him as a peer. But now I find myself in his circles of his family and his friends. So I hear stories about him all the time. And I think I have this really interesting sort of prism about him and who he was. And I mainly know him through his work.
And speaking of his work, one of his songs, which is also on this album, Water, Fire, Wind, was one of the very first songs you learned to play on guitar.
That's right. Yep. It turns out it's in G, the people's key. And so it was a good one to start on. And as I learned to play it, I realized, oh, the melody really falls along the guitar strings in this way that makes it easy to pick out the melody. So that was really exhilarating to feel more skilled than I actually was.
Feel accomplished, yeah, right,
exactly.
Away. Here's a little bit of Water, Fire, Wind.
Hear cathedral bells upon the quay. From a place out over the water. Calling lost souls to come home. Come home, come home. All who have wandered.
So, Rich, tell us about the song Woody's Fire. That's one of the tracks on Solid Ground.
Well, Woody's Fire is, I guess, Fred's telling of Woody Guthrie's life story. I'm not sure if he had read his biography, some of which is actually true, I think, in the biography. but we set out to do it with a kind of Johnny Cash attitude. And I play upright bass on it. But then on the recording, I also bring the washboard in. And I was just noticing there's some good train-style harmonica by Mr. Eric Lewis. And it sort of follows Woody through his life, which was a pretty tough life, you know.
There was really a theme of fire in Woody Guthrie's life. Yeah. And he and his close family experienced a eerie number of fires. I want to say maybe 3 major fires. Wow. Among his immediate family, and people died in them. And so I think Fred was really comparing that to the notion of living an artistic life, and what kind of fire does that exact on an artist, too? Mm-hmm. You know, what are the costs? What's the passion? And so I think Fred is wrestling. Do I want that legacy or not? At least that's how I perceive it.
Woody Guthrie also is meaningful to the two of you.
That's right.
That's right. We named our son after him. His name is Guthrie. I used to work at the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago, and one day someone called to register their kid for a class, and they said that his name was Guthrie, and I was like, ugh, I love that. I love that. We're you know, folk music is our lives, and I consider him, Woody Guthrie, really, you know, one of the most important songwriters an American folk musician could know. And it sort of seemed like a cool homage, and I like the name. And Rich has an interesting take on this, though, about why we like Woody Guthrie.
Why is that?
Well, because you always say, because Woody Guthrie worked both for the government and in sort of subtle resistance to it in this interesting kind of way.
Yeah, at a time when you could be a socialist and past communist and still work for the government.
Support, in their propaganda department.
In the propaganda department, support the dam projects and support all these things. The government at the time knew that the arts were important to explain to the people what they were trying to do, and hired Woody because he was definitely the voice of the people, or voice to the people.
And in what way do you think that Fred Alley is a voice of or to the people?
I think, you know, when you go to Northern Sky Theater now in Door County, the way that a professional theater is accessible to people of all ages and all backgrounds is really unlike any other theatrical experience I've ever had. So you go to theaters anywhere else basically, and you see older people, you see you see like mostly white collar people, and I feel like at Northern Sky Theater, it really you see people of all ages, people of a lot of different kinds of backgrounds, and I think Fred was able to tap into real emotions, but also create high art. So I think he had this really interesting mix of populism and sophistication in his work that is hard to rival. And I think that that comes through in his songs, too.
Beyond the theater itself, what would you say Fred's legacy is here in Wisconsin and beyond?
Well, I would say that Fred's respect for people and people's everyday lived experiences is a special thing and is not found very often. And I think that his legacy maybe is to have found ways of bringing into art and bringing into beauty the Wisconsin lifestyle. You know, he really wrote shows that were centered in a place, grounded in this place in Wisconsin, and making fun of Wisconsin culture in a way that totally said, I'm in it. I'm part of this. Mm-hmm. And I think it's funny. and I think that's what you want. I mean, you want someone to be both your neighbor and your observer. I think in an artist, that's a pretty cool thing.
Well, Rich and Katie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Katie Dahl, singer-songwriter, and Rich Higdon, who is bass player, potter, and percussionist. They are two of the four people who put together the album Solid Ground, which is the music of Fred Alley. And we'll go out listening to Fred Alley's song, Call of the Wild. This is Central Time.
Can I pray you a bedtime prayer that I learned as a child? It's a moment that we can share. It's the call of the
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Have you checked out WPR.org lately? You can listen to past shows, find out about great events in your area, find favorite Central Time segments that you want to share, and get the latest from the WPR News Department. That's all at WPR.org.
Now, we know chili peppers can be hot, and they can add flavor and a kick to everything from Memphis barbecue to Thai peanut sauce.
Beyond that, how much do we really know about them? Our next guest traveled the world in search of answers about where they came from, how they're eaten, and why they became super popular in so many different cultures.
Matt Gross is a New York City-based food and travel writer. His recent piece for Airbnb Magazine is titled, How the Chili Pepper Took Over the World. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I understand this story is very personal for you because you are a chili fan, a chili head. What is it you like about chili peppers?
Oh, well, besides everything? I mean, I love the... It's a kick that is physical. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it once you taste that chemical capsaicin in chili pepper. Your tongue reacts, your mouth reacts, your brain reacts, your body reacts. There's nothing quite like that. And I love how that makes me extra attuned to the food I eat. Not just about that insane heat, it's about how the insane heat brings out all of the other flavors in a dish.
You had your first experience with a chili pepper at a pretty tender age, pun intended, at a farmer's market. Tell us about that story.
Sure. I mean, as I remember it, I was 10 years old, and my mother brought me to a farmer's market in Amherst, Massachusetts, where we lived, and must have been September, October, because some vendor had a bucket of chili peppers, cherry peppers, the sort of squat little things, and took a nibble of one, and I thought, this is not so bad, and took a huge bite and burned my face off. Unforgettable, and, you know, the great thing about chili peppers, when you OD on them at such a young age like that, you realize, I mean, this is, first of all, terrible, but also you survive it, and you survive it, and you kind of want more. You want that experience of living on the edge, of courting fate. And ever since then, I got more and more into hot sauces, chili sauces, plopping chilies in my food, and it's wound up bringing me around the world and exposing me to all kinds of foods and cultures that I never would have otherwise.
Now, here's the weirdest thing for me about this story of the spread of the chili pepper, Matt. There are cultures where we think, oh, chili peppers, Thailand or India, parts of China, Hungary, parts of Africa. Oh, chili peppers, such a big part of their cuisine. They didn't have any of them just like 500 years ago, right?
Yeah, exactly. Chili peppers are native to the Americas. They emerged in the wild around Bolivia. They were first domesticated in what is now Mexico's Tehuacan Valley in the state of Puebla. And they didn't leave the Americas until a guy named Columbus showed up in 1492, and he and his people brought them back to Spain and Portugal. And from there, that's when the journey started. The short version of it is the Portuguese did it. They carried chilies to West Africa, to East Africa, to India, to Southeast Asia, and beyond. But all of those cuisines, Indian food didn't have chilies, Thai food didn't have chilies, Sichuan food in China didn't have chilies. It's crazy. And you didn't even have bell peppers either. Like, you think, oh, bell peppers seem like such a basic part of, you know, European cuisine, but that's just another form of chili pepper that they didn't have. So all of that stuff is completely new. The chili pepper, you know, in the span of a couple hundred years, just totally remade cooking all over the world.
And when they were first just in the Americas, do we have a sense of how many different varieties there were then and here?
Yeah, there's something like 31 different species of chili peppers, but only five of them have really been domesticated. The most popular, they're all of the genus Capsicum. So they're all, the most popular ones are the Capsicum annuum, which includes the jalapeno, the Capsicum chinense, which includes the habanero and some of the, like, the most burn-your-face-off chilies in the universe, and the Capsicum frutescens, which is, I believe, like, Tabasco peppers, Tabasco peppers are part of that category. Those are, like, the three worldwide most popular. There's a couple other domesticated ones, but they were all over, and within those species are, like, a zillion different, you know, slight variations, one that's more wrinkly, one with a thicker skin, one with a thinner skin, one that's, you know, some that are sweeter, some that are, you know, have a more dry flavor. And, of course, all different levels of heat within those different species.
Right. It's like dogs, right? I mean, Chihuahuas and Mastiffs are part of the same species, but they're pretty different. Same thing in the world of peppers, right?
Exactly. It's just like dogs, but it tastes better.
Let's not even go there.
So Matt, you talked about that there's a huge range of heat, and there's, I believe it's called the Scoville scale. How is it decided how hot a pepper is?
Oh man, so there's this guy who over 100 years ago created this scale, and his idea was you would dry out chilies, you would soak them in a liquid, I think it was either an alcohol or water, to pull out the flavor. And then you would dilute that liquid in enormous parts of water until a panel of tasters could no longer sense the heat. So if it took 2,000 drops of water to counteract one drop of chili liquid, you would say that was 2,000 Scoville units,
oh,
which is about what a jalapeno is. But that's crazy. That requires panels of testers, all this elaborate stuff, and it's hugely subjective. So in the last 20 or 30 years, they use something called high-performance laser chromatography, which basically just you take these dried chilies and extract some of their material, put it in a machine, and it says how much of the weight of this thing is made up of capsaicinoids, these chemicals that cause the feeling of heat. So that's a much more sort of scientific and locked down way. And they've matched it up so that what you get out of the machine corresponds to what these crazy panels of tasters were figuring out on their own 100 years ago. And, you know, the ranges go, you know, down from like 500 Scoville units, 2,000 Scoville units for things like jalapenos or Anaheim chilies, up to, you know, 150,000 for a habanero to, you know, 2 million Scoville units for the Carolina Reaper, which is currently, although maybe not for long, the holder of the Guinness World Record for the spiciest chili on earth.
Oh, we can't. You just teased that. What do you mean not for long?
So the guy who invented the Carolina Reaper, his name is Ed Curry, Smokin' Ed Curry. He's this crazy South Carolina farmer, has been developing something that he's called Pepper X, which is reportedly 3 million Scoville units. And, you know, that's like half again as spicy as the Carolina Reaper.
Now, we're talking like this is a similar thing as like pepper spray, right, in terms of the intensity?
Well, pepper spray is like 6 million to 15 million Scoville units. So it's like half a dose of pepper spray. I mean,
in your mouth.
Come on, that's nothing. But I got to taste Pepper X a couple of years ago at the NYC Hot Sauce Expo. Ed Curry was carrying around a little jar of mashed up Pepper X, and he gave me a tiny, you know, like an eighth of a teaspoon of it. And it's very hot. but it's also delicious. Like, I spent 10 minutes yelling into a friend's, video phone about how delicious it was, how full of flavor, I was out of my mind at the time because of the heat, but it was really, it's really kind of amazing to see, to taste a pepper that is so insanely spicy, but also so incredibly flavorful. So, I mean, I'm super looking forward to when that thing gets its Guinness World Record and when he releases it to the public, because that's going to change everything all over again.
We're talking about chili peppers with food and travel writer Matt Gross.
And we want to hear from you. Do you like chilies? What's your favorite? Have you ever had a really, really hot one? Do you use them in your own cooking or do you leave it to the pros? Tell us if you consider chili peppers hot or not. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll pick up that conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Matt Gross. He's a food and travel writer and spent this summer in Jamaica, Hungary, and Thailand to learn about the origins of the chili pepper, how they're used, and why they're so popular around the world.
What about you? Do you like chilies? What's the most memorable chili dish you've had, and where did you have it? Do you like to challenge yourself to eat hotter food than you think you can tolerate, or is just a little bit of heat fine with you? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
So, Matt, I want to ask a question about building up a tolerance for really hot peppers, because I worked in a Chinese restaurant for a long time. The cooks liked me, so they would share their own food with me, which was often quite spicy. I ate that a lot. And then I went and lived in Russia for a year, and Russians are not big on strong seasonings. Garlic is kind of the primary one. I came back thinking I could eat the same things I was eating here before I left and almost died because I had lost my tolerance. What is it? How do we build up a tolerance? And in places where they're really common, do people have a much higher level of what they can take?
I mean, the way to build up tolerance is just to eat. You have to, start back at the bottom and work your way back to the top like Rocky. it's just how it goes. I mean, sure, you could launch back up to the hottest chilies, but you might not be able to take that. My wife, for example, after each of our kids was born, she totally lost her ability to take heat. So all of a sudden the kid was out, boom, she was back to square one. It was very frustrating. But, she's worked her way back up each time, partly because we just have a lot of chilies around the house all the time. She's got no choice, really. In places I've been, like Thailand, I asked almost everybody that I interviewed to rate their chili tolerance. And the average Thai, I can tell you, rates their chili tolerance as above average. No one is ever willing to admit that they have only average Thai levels of chili tolerance. Everybody is slightly above average. And that can cause some crazy scenes. A friend of mine tells a story about a girl that he was dating in Thailand, and they would go out to eat, and she would measure her chili tolerance by his chili tolerance. He was new to the country. He was from New York. So she felt like she had to be able to eat things that were, three times as spicy as he could eat. And this went on, but over time, his chili tolerance built up. So he started getting spicier food, and naturally she would get stuff that was still three times as spicy until, they'd be at dinner and she would just be sweating and panting through the whole meal, unable to take the food that she'd ordered. But she was so determined because she was Thai that she had to be eating food that was way spicier than any foreigner could possibly eat. even if she couldn't eat it herself.
Spicy pepper arms races. Let's go to our callers now. Andrew is with us in Green Bay. Andrew, hi there.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. Do you have a pepper story for us?
Yeah. So we're beginning farmers up in Green Bay, and my girlfriend is from New Mexico, so we decided that peppers were going to be one of our specialty. And we were searching through the catalogs, and we found this amazing heatless habanero pepper. So it's got all of the flavor of a habanero, as complex as it is, which I just love the flavor, but without any kind of heat. It's actually terrifying to eat because you're munching on it. You think that all of a sudden your face is going to burn off, but it just ends up in this sweet, amazing flavor that it's almost more addicting than the heat that comes with it.
I look forward to trying those, Andrew. Thanks for calling in, Matt. And that speaks to not just the heatless part, but there's a lot of flavor in these peppers and a lot of variety apart from the heat itself, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way people talk about it is kind of difficult. People will say things are fruity or citrusy or sweet, but sometimes you get things that are a lot more complex. There's a kind of dry heat. One of the things we think about when we talk about chilies is, where does that heat hit you, and how does it work with the flavor that's in the chili itself? Is it hitting you right in the front of the mouth, back of the throat, sides of the tongue? It's a series of pieces that all work together, ideally.
Let's go back to the phones, and William in Milwaukee is up. Hi, William.
Hello there.
What would you like to say?
All right, so I've got a bit of a story about my experiences with the Carolina Reaper.
Oh, and you're alive, so we know how it ends, but fill us in the middle.
It was something special. So it was last year, in summer, with the Woodman's down Oak Creek actually had Carolina Reapers in stock. So I decided, rather stupidly, to pick up a pack because I was planning on making chili that week.
Oh,
so
my
I was
gosh.
Like, so after cooking up all the other peppers in my cast iron skillet, mind you, so it's already starting to get a little tough to breathe inside, I decided to put on, just thinking, oh, this will help, just a bandana over my mouth and forehead, and just started cooking them up in a little butter. No, I started coughing. Everyone started coughing. The cats started coughing.
Oh, no.
And I basically had to vent out the entire house just to be sure that everyone stopped, you know, basically in the effects of tear gas. And mind you, it was delicious when it all was said and done. But if you're going to cook Reapers, everyone, make sure to be in a well ventilated area and please use like a gas mask or something.
William, thanks a lot. Is this a thing, Matt? We have to have occupational safety measures before we cook some of these things?
Oh yeah, I mean, you should feel free to have the vents on, the windows open. I met some guys in Hungary who were not making traditional Hungarian paprika, but making crazy hot sauces with Reapers and ghost peppers and stuff. And they had gas masks. They use if they're making hot sauce, they put on their gas masks because it just makes it easier. If you're around that all the time, you take precautions. And gloves, please, gloves when you're cutting some of those insanely hot peppers. I have made certain mistakes before with not wearing gloves, and I have paid dearly, and so have some people who are very close to me.
We're talking with Matt Gross right now. He's a food and travel writer and recently wrote a piece titled How the Chili Pepper Took Over the World. Let's go back to the phones, and Marty in Whitewater is up. Hi, Marty.
Hey, guys. My little story is, you know, my son and I, we like the hot stuff, and we've been in a couple of places where either we have to sign a piece of paper, a waiver, avoiding them of any liability, or we've had the chef stand in the doorway and watch us as we partake of the wings. But the best thing was we were in Galena, and it's nothing but shops on either side of the street, and we're walking. All of a sudden, here's this guy coming toward us, and he's stuck in wind. You know, he goes past us. We're looking at him like, what's wrong with this guy? So we proceed forward a little bit, and oh, here's a new hot sauce shop. So we walk in, and of course, here's a bowl of ghost pepper sauce. You put a little bit of this on the tip of a pencil, and you're good to go, you know. But the best part is reading the labels of these bottles. You know, our favorite was it had four nuns on the label. There was like rocket flames coming out from underneath their garb, and it was called Holy Effin' Sauce. it was more fun reading the labels, and you know, it kind of tempered the heat.
Marty, thanks a lot. And Matt, a lot of creativity goes into naming the hot sauces, the hot pepper sauces on the market, and making them themselves. Can you talk a little bit about the world of variety when it comes to hot pepper sauces?
Oh, my God. There's so many hot sauces out there. All of those, you know, very colorful labels with names of sauces that we probably can't necessarily even say on the radio.
True.
That comes out of this great tradition of people discovering hot sauce pretty much like in the 80s. Dave's Insanity Sauce was the first of those crazy, super hot, ultra graphic labels. And they've been joined, I mean, that sort of movement of, I don't know, like a lot of guys into like heavy metal and barbecue and, you know, this sort of like tough guy American culture created that world of hot sauce. And that's been joined in the last 5-10 years by a lot of immigrant hot sauces, a lot of people who have started making hot sauce like it was done in the old country, whether that's Guyana or Panama or Mozambique. And then there's a whole sort of segment of very restaurant-driven hot sauces, people experimenting with cool ingredients and new flavors. There's a woman in who lives across the street from me in Brooklyn who goes by the name of Queen Majesty, who has like an amazing red habanero and coffee hot sauce. And it just sort of feels very in line with modern restaurant trends in terms of how flavors are put together. She's won a ton of awards for that hot sauce as well. And it just keeps expanding and expanding and expanding. Getting into making hot sauce is not that hard to do, not that expensive to do. And if you can make something that people love, people keep buying it and buying it and buying it.
Matt, I want to ask you about one of the three countries that you went to look at chilies, because it's Hungary, and I'm not sure that would be one of the first countries people would think of, but paprika is the national spice of Hungary. What is paprika?
Paprika is just ground dried chilies, but it has evolved over hundreds of years into the signature flavoring of Hungary. The chefs I talked to there said it was in probably about 2/3 of everything that everybody makes. It's in goulash and paprikash, and it's in little dishes on tables. It is, you know, the thing that defines Hungarian cuisine. You see peppers on T-shirts, you know, taking the place of the S in Budapest. Like, it's just, it's constantly everywhere. But in a lot of cases, the people I talked to there didn't even know where it had come from. It had been brought to Hungary in the 16th century by the Ottoman Empire, by the Turks who invaded and took over most of Hungary and brought peppers along with them, which they'd gotten from Arabs, which they'd gotten from the Portuguese. It's just a weird, like, long, long chain of handing off peppers from one person to the next, along with the wisdom about how to grow them, prepare them, cook with them, and eat them. Hungary is just suffused with this red everywhere you go, and people are very proud of it.
Matt, briefly, as we finish up, I understand you're working on a book about peppers. I hope you'll join us again for that. You went to Hungary, Thailand, and Jamaica for this article. Where's your next stop in your quest for peppers?
Oh, man. I want to go back to Thailand because there's a lot more to dig into there. I want to hop around Indonesia and try some more sambals, which are sort of like Indonesian-style salsas. I need to get to Mexico. Oh, man, I haven't been there in a long time, and that is, you know, that's the homeland.
All right, Matt, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me. I loved it.
Matt Gross is a New York City-based food and travel writer. His recent piece was titled How the Chili Pepper Took Over the World.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at the Cold War as it played out here in Wisconsin. From spies to nuclear research to politicians to shipbuilding, the Badger State felt the effects of that decades-long conflict.
And film critic Reggie Ponder joins us for a look back at 2018's best movie offerings, and we'll ask what your favorites were.
All that and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.